this is Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is an English author, journalist and speaker based in Denmark. She relocated with her husband to Jutland, Denmark, leaving her job as editor of marieclaire.co.uk in London and embarking upon a freelance career. In 2015, her debut book, The Year of Living Danishly, Uncovering the Secrets of the World's Happiest Country, became an international bestseller and was translated into 21 languages. She's also written for The Guardian as Scandinavia correspondent, The Daily Telegraph, The Observer, Stylist and Grazia. Her sixth book, How to Raise a Viking, uncovers the secrets to parenting the world's happiest children. Helen Russell, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure.
Tell us a little bit about your life pre-Denmark. So it sounds like you had an incredibly busy career.
I did, yes. I was living and working in London for 12 years as a journalist. I had no intention of leaving. And then out of the blue on Wet Wednesday, my husband came home and told me he'd been offered this job in Denmark. And not Copenhagen, not the jazzy part that everyone's heard of, but rural Jutland. But Denmark had just been voted the happiest country in the world. And as a naturally nosy person, I became fascinated by this, so thought maybe this year experiment might work. But yes, prior to that, knew nothing about the Nordic countries, very much an indoor city girl, not outdoorsy at all. So yes, it was a complete switch, really, moving there.
And did your husband have any Viking connections?
No, not at all. No, both British, both pretty clueless in the ways of Nordic life, as well as parenting, as it turned out. But yes.
Yeah. So when you first got there, I mean, was that a bit discombobulating?
Well, the weather's terrible, for starters. You can't not notice that people are sort of rushing around trying to get indoors in winter because it's so cold and dark. But yes, as soon as I arrived, I noticed that people were different. They didn't quite look like us, not just because they were all strapping Vikings towering above me, but people walked more slowly. They took their time to stop and eat together. Babies were left to nap outside in their prams, even in the snow. And rush hour starts at around 3 because office hours are maybe 8 till 4 and they have this great work-life balance. So I noticed straight away that it was not at all like NW6 anymore.
And being in a very rural part, I mean, that must have been a big change for you too.
Yes, it was. I did not own Wellingtons. I had to be slowly kitted out. The Danes like to say there's no such thing as bad weather, just the wrong clothes. And I resisted for the longest time. But they all have what Stanford psychologists call the positive wintertime mindset. So they think, well, if you dress for it, you'll be fine. But I resisted for ever so long. And there was just no one around. I live in a town now. But when I first arrived, it was just me and a few owls. There was a bus stop once with a dog tied to it. But there was nobody around, no internationals. I didn't speak the language, had no friends, no family. So, yeah, big culture shock.
You live in a town that you call the Pony Porn Town.
Yes.
Tell us why.
Well, the prominent local landmark of Vejle in Jutland is a horse standing on its hind legs in full frontal glory, surrounded by cats with breasts. So we began referring to it affectionately as the Pawny Pony. And then that's sort of taken off. Now I get sent pictures by people who've gone on almost a pilgrimage there to take a picture of themselves with the Pawny Pony. So yeah, the Pawny Pony Town is now home.
Can I ask, is the pony a stallion?
He's a stallion, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Okay, on my wish list.
See you there.
The Year of Living Danishly, what a wonderful title for your first book. Tell us about the premise of that.
Well, as I say, I was just trying to go for a year. I didn't really want to relocate. So I said, well, I'll give it a year. We'll do it for a year. We'll see. And I thought, well, why does Denmark keep coming top of these happiness polls? And not just the one then, but all the way back to the 1970s, I thought there must be something different that Danes are doing. Is it something in the water? Is it Lego, beer, bacon? So I thought, well, I'm going to look at every area of Danish life to see what it was that they did differently and what I could take with me when I thought I would return back to London pretty soon. So I began investigating. And in London, we'd been trying to start a family for years. We'd had years of fertility treatment, but nothing seemed to be working. And then halfway through my year of living Danishly, I found out that I was suddenly pregnant and had a tricky pregnancy. So then the year slipped into two. This book came about. I was writing about Scandinavia for UK newspapers, and then it became a book. And then there was this sort of explosion of interest in the Nordic countries, I think, because people were looking for answers, looking for a different way of life. And I think the Nordic countries did and still do have quite a lot that they can teach us.
Mm, absolutely. And now, of course, your next book is all about having children in that country and how you bring them up to be happy. Let's talk a little bit about your second pregnancy, though, and IVF generally in not only Denmark, but you are talking generally about the Nordic countries.
Yes, there are fewer invasive treatments. There's less monitoring. It's kind of Viking, the approach. Somebody came at me when I was pregnant with an ear trumpet, which I wasn't expecting. I thought there maybe would be a scan of some kind, but apparently Peanut's horn worked just fine. But it's much more relaxed. You're allowed to carry on exercising as normal. I spoke to Norwegian mothers-to-be who said, oh no, I was skiing 6 months pregnant. Other than a few, you know, the general advice not to drink alcohol, not to smoke, it's pretty much business as usual. So yes, pregnancy is quite relaxed there. There's great parental leave, as we all read about in the Nordic countries.
And lots of help to get IVF.
There's lots of help, yes. So I think 10% of children are conceived with fertility treatment in Denmark. So it's just very normalised. And it means that the kind of family formations that can often mean that you're likely to be worse off or can attract stigma in this country are perfectly normal there. I think there's about 37 different types of family, the Danish government have noted. I have two friends right now having babies solo with donor sperm. It's just much more normalised. So your bog standard fertility treatment and IVF, it's now actually it's free for your first child and it's now free for your second child as well. When it wasn't when I was there, but it was still a lot cheaper than it would have been had I been doing IVF in London.
And of course, you now have twins.
I now have twins. Surprise. Twins, yes. So from going from no children, then 3 years later, suddenly three was quite a shock.
Now, there's a whole chapter on donors. I was kind of sitting there absolutely rapt and my partner came in and he said, what are you reading about? I said, oh, Danish sperm. So tell us about Danish sperm.
Well, I can see why you're rapt. Yes. So Denmark is sort of this, it's another major export, the one they don't talk about. We'd all talk about Lego and beer and bacon. But yes, sperm. Denmark sends its sperm to 100 countries worldwide. Donations to the UK have been increasing year on year. They now account for 30% of all new imported sperm in the UK. So they're calling it almost like the gentle Viking invasion. It's big there. It's more affordable. There's no stigma attached for the donors. So they're not motivated by money. They don't get paid very much, maybe about 50 quid for a donation. But there's more of a culture of altruism and volunteering and donating of all kinds. So it's more normalised. And it's something that people don't snigger about. I still do, obviously, because I'm British. But Danes don't tend to snigger about it. So it's quite normal. You're allowed to be an anonymous donor in Denmark as well. So that helps. I think more donors are likely to come forward and be happy to be involved. But yeah, it's a big industry in Denmark.
And you divide the donors up into different types.
I do. Yes. So there are these, I call them the young bucks. These are the men with no real experience of children. Often they're not even that fond of children, but they feel like it'd be a good thing to do. And they want to test, because when you become a sperm donor, you go through a series of very rigorous tests to see if your sperm is good enough to conceive via donor. This doesn't mean that you can't be a father. It just means you can't be a sperm donor, because it has to go through much more difficult tests. So a lot of young men, these young bucks, they want to see whether their sperm is in inverted commas good enough. Then there are the family guys, people who already have a family of their own and know how important that is and how much it means to them. And so very kindly and altruistically, they just think, I want to make sure everybody has that opportunity. And as they say in Denmark, there's not the same sense of, there's not sort of prejudice. So they think if you're single, if you're gay, you should have the same opportunity to have a family if you want to and are able to look after a child. And then there are the donor disciples. And these are the men often with experience of donor babies in real life. So many of the men I spoke to said, oh, you know, my sister had a baby by donor sperm, or my friend is going through the process now, and they really see how it works and how rigorous there are the big psychological interviews. There's a lot of health screening and they just want to be a part of it. They think it's a good thing and they want to contribute.
Mm. Now, as you say in the book, if you're an expectant mother, all you have to turn up with at the hospital is your toothbrush. And this is because so much state help is given to expectant mothers. But that's not just expectant mothers. It seems to be that the state aids people across the board.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. I mean, you are paying for it in your taxes, and often when I talk about this, people from the UK and the US think, well, I love the idea of the Nordic thing, but I don't want to pay the tax. But it all sort of comes back around. You know, you're paying these high taxes, but yes, you have this great healthcare, you have this great education all the way up to university. It's free, you can get paid to study with student grants. Remember those? But there's a sense that even though you get paid parental leave and subsidised childcare, 75% subsidised in Denmark, but it makes sense. It's not purely because they're trying to be kind. Childcare pays for itself. The Norwegian government recently valued the contribution of working mothers and put it at £626 billion. So it's the equivalent of the oil reserves. The money comes back. It's worth investing in. So the Danes take that mentality. They're not trying to do anyone a favour. They invest in helping people have children, helping working mothers get back to work, because losing them makes poor financial sense. And happy parents make for a happier economy.
Mm. And how does it work out in terms of gender equality in the workplace?
It's really interestingly so. Sweden has the shared parental leave for the longest. And this wasn't something Swedish men were asking for. There weren't placards in the streets, but it was decided that this was good for the economy, good for the women. And Sweden has a bit more of a gender balance when you get to CEO level, for example. In Denmark and Finland and Iceland, the other Nordic countries, there is still a disparity. So although men and women both work, 80% of mothers work, in the very top jobs, you're still seeing largely men in many cases. But it's not that dissimilar to the UK levels. In the US, where there is much more of a kind of capitalist corporate culture, shall we say, then again, you know, your women are often having to make very difficult choices about family or career. And so you can see that if you're taking a lot of time out for parental leave, it can have an impact. And even in great countries with great parental leave, Sweden gets 480 days parental leave. In Sweden, you still see something called the sickness gap, whereby those, usually the mothers who are the primary caregivers for the child, for the first 10 years of that child's life will tend to get ill, for example, more often. So the domestic load, I recently wrote about this for The Guardian, but the domestic load is shared a lot more equally in the Nordics than it is in the UK. But there are still women who are, they call it managers of the family, to some degree in the Nordics. And in Sweden, this manifests in this sickness gap.
Mm. And do you think the fact that Denmark, as you say, is consistently voted the happiest country in the world is about what metrics we measure happiness on? Do we in Britain just have a different idea of what happiness is?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I guess it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's a very difficult thing to measure. You look at the way Bhutan does it, the gross national happiness. But I think they're looking at well-being. They're looking at things like education, this idea of how much you can trust your community. I think they're measuring the same things in both places. And Danes, they have something called Jante's Law, where you're not supposed to show off and bragging about anything is frowned on. So Danes are never going to say, oh, yes, we're the happiest in the world. It's brilliant here. They have a similar sense of humour to ours in the UK in that they love a moan. They love to complain about the weather. There's plenty of weather to complain about. So I think there's a sense that they are happy. If you actually get any Dane one-on-one and say, are you pleased to be in Denmark or somewhere else? Most people will say, I'm glad I was born in Denmark. It's a good life. But I think that's what I was interested in. How do you build a Viking from the ground up? We see these Nordics, they're happier and healthier. They're always coming out top of these polls. Well, how does that happen? And I discovered by speaking to experts, and I'm very much the student here, that it starts really early. It starts from the bottom. And the way that they are parented into adulthood is what makes for these happier, healthier, more resilient, independent Nordics.
Let's start from the bottom with the word Viking, because, of course, when we think of it, we think of a man with a helmet on with the horns. That's actually not true at all.
No, so interesting. Yes, so we only think that they wore horned helmets because Wagner had a production of his Ring Cycle, and the costume designer that he got in decided to put in some horned helmets, and it was such a hit, this production, that that took off. And so, yeah, all the tea towels started getting printed with horned helmets, but no, never wore them. So the Nordic countries are Iceland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, but Viking typically doesn't include Finland. However, historians are now saying that the history of early Finland is pretty Viking heavy, but because they were being dominated by Russia at the time, this wasn't promoted so much. And by the time Finland did start sort of talking about getting its independence and talking about its Viking heritage, the idea is that the juggernaut had sort of moved on, that we'd already thought of Viking as the other one. But I'm including Viking with the umbrella term over all of these five Nordic countries because there are many similarities between them is this outdoorsy culture, this emphasis on physicality, taking risks, but also caring. So you think of this tough exterior like Vikings that you talked about, but they're also very caring, and there's compassion and collaboration. These are the values that are really promoted and cultivated in that society.
And the difference between Nordic countries and Scandinavian countries?
Scandinavia is Norway, Sweden and Denmark, and then Nordic is the five. So it's Iceland, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark.
So in terms of building a Viking, and you've now built three of your own.
Trying.
When you go back, we've talked about birth and so on, but I mean, you talk very amusingly in the book about having a toddler that is proficient with an axe but can't yet spell.
Yes. So they're not that fussed about book learning till much later. So children don't start school till the age of 6 or 7 in Finland. They won't learn to read much before 8, which obviously was really alarming when I first moved there. But they will let them have, yes, knives, axes. My children were all regulars at the terrifying Viking institution known as Family Scouts. So as preschoolers, they would all be sort of whittling, learning axe throwing. My son was asked whether he needed like a fixed blade or a penknife or a flick knife. I have found myself saying the now famous family phrase, you can have a saw once you're 4, to my 2-year-olds. Just another world.
That is extraordinary, though, isn't it? Weather, of course, as we've discussed, but children are encouraged to be outside. And it's indeed, as you say, they're put outside to nap, perhaps without anybody even looking after them.
Yes, there is this great word, tillit, that means trust and faith. And it's really this linchpin of Danish society. There is trust and faith that no harm will come to them, that it's good for babies. Many Danes believe that it's really good for babies' lungs to be outside, breathing in this fresh air. A Finnish study showed that they sleep better that way. But actually, there's not that much science on it, not that much data. Just culturally, it's very normal. So that's what kids do. And yes, outside no matter what, which it makes a huge difference if you're dressed for it. They often laugh at the sort of British children being quite underdressed for the weather. And actually, when you've got wet, cold feet, you can't really participate and spend much time outdoors, which we know is so good for health and well-being. So they have an awful lot of kit. My children have snowsuits, rain suits, wind suits, balaclavas, winter boots, normal boots, gum boots, but you borrow, you buy second hand, you rent, you take hand-me-downs, just anything so that children can be outside in nature, because that's what Nordics think is really good for children's development. They think they behave better, they learn to collaborate, they learn to be more resilient, because it is quite cold and wet. Even if it's only your face that's exposed, it's pretty unpleasant often, the weather.
There was a very famous case in America, wasn't there?
Yes. So this was a Dane who left her baby sleeping outside a cafe in New York and was arrested for child neglect. And this was in the late 90s. And I spoke to her for this book, Annetta, and she's very calm, but she's still very shocked by the US response. She just cannot fathom. It just seems mad that the US media really took against her. And there was such, she was, eventually all charges were dropped. The Danish press really rallied around her. But in Denmark, no one steals babies, people kept saying to me. And actually the last case was in the 1960s. And obviously it's incredibly alarming that the baby was returned very soon afterwards. But it's just culturally, it's allowed to happen. There are high levels of trust. 79% of Danes trust most people. And it's just accepted that if you trust the people around you, they're likely to behave better. You can have the headspace to be happy if you're not anxious all the time. So they believe it's just more helpful to assume the best of people.
Mm. We think of dairy products when we think about Vikings and what they consume. Is that necessarily the case?
Yeah, Arla, very big. Yeah, a lot of milk. My sons call themselves the Arla boys. They're so obsessed with the milk. But yes, there's a lot of dairy, a lot of meat still. People tend to eat quite sort of hearty meals. It's not always healthy. Butter, they have a great phrase in Denmark for tooth butter, when you slather on the Lurpak so thick that when you bite into it, you see your teeth marks. So really big on dairy and meat. They have something called a waiting sausage that you have in the queue while you wait for the main event sausage to be cooked. So it's not always healthy, but it is hearty, rib-sticking food, which is really quite appropriate in the weather often. And they're quite relaxed about food. I thought, really, from a culture that seems to be throwing back to the 1950s in many ways, I thought that there'd be rules around food and family mealtimes and you sit down and you eat your food, but none of it. No, it's when children are hungry, you feed them and you serve up regular hearty meals. And if a child doesn't want to eat it then, but wants something plain half an hour later, there's no fuss and they're allowed it. Yeah, very different.
And in terms of health, I mean, this would not seem to be the ideal diet if you're trying to avoid a heart attack. Are there stats on that?
Danes aren't massively healthy. I mean, there's a big emphasis on vegetables as well, I should say. So Danes get lunchboxes at school. Children have lunchboxes and they tend to have quite a lot of crudités in them, for example. Swedes and Finns have free school lunches. And that's been shown to be massively helpful with health. It helps children grow taller, grow a centimetre taller since the school lunches were introduced, achieve 3% higher lifetime salary because they have the opportunity to concentrate and they do better. In Denmark, the health outcomes, Denmark is thought of as almost the party nation of the Nordic countries. So they're libertarians. There are rules for society and there's this real emphasis on tillid, this trust and faith, and samfundsyn or community mindset. So they look after each other. But within these rules, there is freedom within these boundaries. So they feel like we pay our high taxes, we can live how we like. We've paid for this healthcare system. If I want to have a sausage and an ice cream and a cigarette, maybe all at once, then I shall jolly well do that. So they're quite relaxed in that way, which pros and cons. I think coming from growing up in the UK diet culture and working in women's magazines, I find it quite liberating that sort of anything goes approach to food now.
Tell us about Potato Week.
Potato Week, yes. So this is week 42 in the calendar. Danes like to mark the calendar in years. So this is week 7 right now. And Potato Week is when traditionally in Jylland, where I live, it's farmer country. And so the farmers would all take their children out of school to help with the potato harvest. And the schools got a bit sick of this, thinking, well, hang on. I mean, really, it's very hard to teach the class when there's hardly anyone there. So they said, right, you all help harvest the potatoes in week 42. And now it's just become the Danish half term. You know, not everyone works in farming anymore. There's still a real kind of farming heritage. And I have farmer friends, something I never thought I'd say. And it's still part of the week. And so this year we had a lot of rain. Denmark's had an awful lot of rain recently. And so a lot of the potatoes were getting waterlogged in the earth. No one could get them out in time. And so there were appeals on Facebook going, hey, come to my field, help dig out the potatoes. You just think, oh, wow, this is my life now. This is different. And so it's still very much part of the culture that Potato Week, Kartoffler, week 42, you eat your extra potatoes. If there's any knocking around, you help dig them out. And yeah.
Now, you've also interestingly written and indeed podcast on sadness, the flip side of happiness. What has living in the happiest country in the world taught you about sadness?
Oh, it's interesting. I think there's a couple of things. I think there's so much pressure on the individual in the UK and in the US as well, and in many cultures that if you're not happy, there is a feeling that something must be wrong, that you are somehow not trying or not manifesting hard enough. And I think that's really problematic. And spending time in the Nordic countries has really highlighted to me how there are systematic problems. There's sort of structural inequality. There are issues that you can't meditate your way out of a 40-hour working week with no childcare. So the idea that we are expecting individuals to somehow slap on a smile and be jazz hands when actually there's not an adequate benefit system or there's not sufficient childcare that's affordable and accessible. So that really felt important to sort of dig into. If you are sad, it is a signal that something's wrong. Sadness is normal. It's normally a response when you experience loss and disappointment. But what's also increasingly an issue, as with globalization, with social media coming into the Nordics, just as it is everywhere, is that if you live in the happiest country in the world and you don't feel happy, then many are now kind of picking up the idea that, oh, maybe I actually feel worse now. I'm surrounded by these people who I'm told that I live in the happiest country. I'm surrounded by people who seem happy. In Denmark, a lot of charities that work with mental health see around April time, when it suddenly stops being winter lasts till April in the Nordics, that they get more calls because people suddenly come out of hibernation from winter. It's springtime. People start living their lives outdoors again. And if you're feeling down and then you see other people having a really nice time around you, then you tend to feel worse by comparison. So it's really interesting. I think it's taught me about the problem of comparison and then the real issue that we need to sort of lobby for proper political change to help people who are struggling rather than saying this is your problem, you're an individual, you just didn't try hard enough. Mm.
And surely some control over the digital space must be part of that.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So Denmark has a sort of social codex to give children freedom. It's a legacy from the Second World War when Denmark was occupied. And there was a sense that after that, we really want to encourage an anti-authoritarian streak. We want to encourage people to challenge authority, to question, and freedom really above all else. But that same social codex has now been applied to the digital space, with children often by age 9 having a smartphone in Denmark. And Denmark is actually the country where the most screen time is used as part of school. And this came as a real shock to me. I felt after a very wholesome, outdoorsy childhood, this digital blind spot seemed like a real issue. And actually, the Minister for Education in Denmark has said, actually, No, he put his foot down and said, it's gone too far. We do need proper guidance around it. He's looking at screen time guidance. He's looking at mobile free schools, more analogue learning, and times that you put away the tablet, put away the computer in the classroom just to get back to it. So I'm really glad it's starting to be recognised. But Denmark is not perfect by any means. But this real digital blind spot really struck me as something that, well, that's not going to help future Vikings.
I wonder if it's easy to raise happy children in a happy nation, but if a lot of it actually stems from the fact that it is a tiny place, it's quite a homogenous society. People seem to raise kids in the same sort of way. They share the same culture. Does this extend to minorities living in Denmark?
That's a really great question. I think what's really interesting, and I was very sceptical about this as well, but I've done a lot of research into trust and spoken to the experts on trust and looking at migration into Denmark, into the happiest country. And actually the trust professors and psychologists I've spoken to said that people coming from low trust societies will very soon adopt the high trust approach to life that is in the Nordics and will start reporting themselves happier. So although it can seem very problematic that, you know, the neighbours are doing the same thing as their neighbours and possibly as their grandparents, actually coming there as an outsider, and I acknowledge all of my privilege there, that coming to Denmark as a white middle-class woman, my experience will have been very different to someone coming from elsewhere. But even from people coming from all over the world, that migration statistics have shown that actually people end up having these higher trust levels and reporting being happier, no matter their background in that respect. So I think there is something in the structure and the culture of trust that makes it easier to think, it's easier to live my life this way. This does seem to be many good things about it.
Mm. And just looking ahead then to what the future holds for Denmark, I mean, I want to say the world, but who knows? You say in your epilogue that by 2050, economists predict that 40% of current jobs will be lost to automation. So how do we know what our children need when we don't know what their future holds?
That's just it, isn't it? I mean, it's just impossible to know how to help the next generation on their way. I'd say what Denmark does really well is teaches children how to think, not what to think. And in our fast-paced world, where much of what we currently know is likely to become redundant, seems like a really good plan, because we know that collaboration and empathy and the ability to work in a community is going to be really important. So I feel as though my children may not be quite reading the classics just yet, or for many years to come, although actually OECD studies do show that by age 15, all the Nordics get there in the end. They're above the OECD average then. So they're not being pressured to learn very fast. But the idea is they'll have this flexibility and empathy and ability to collaborate that will put them in good stead for whatever the future holds.
Mm. And just finally, of course, we're talking at a time when we don't know what's going to happen in Ukraine, what Russia's going to do next. But of course, when we think about Vikings, we do think about a warlike nation. What's Denmark's attitude to some kind of looming world war crisis?
I think they are engaged. I think on mainland Europe, there is a sense that it's never far away. You know, I think people that were sort of driving to the borders of the countries neighbouring Denmark, there is a sense that there is nowhere to hide. You are part of mainland Europe. You are in it. There was much bafflement when the UK left the EU.
And so, here too.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But I think there's a sense that, I mean, I can't speak on behalf of all Danes here, but there's a lot of sympathy and there's a lot of empathy. And
war lives in the collective memory, really, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah, so the Second World War certainly looms large in a way that I'd never expected it to in my children's lives. Like, I live opposite a World War II bunker. There's a sense that we must never let that happen again. And so standing up for the underdog, and Jante's Law again, this idea that everyone is equal, everyone is worthy of respect just because. So I think that really runs through like a rock. There's no hierarchy. It's not perfect, but this idea that equality is what we should be aiming for. So I think that for modern day Vikings is more of the ethos rather than, you know, marauding.
Absolutely. Helen, thank you so much for talking to me.
Pleasure, thank you.
How to Raise a Viking, The Secrets of Parenting the World's Happiest Children is by Helen Russell. It's published by Fourth Estate and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the producer Tamsin Howard. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.